major international business, drawing 35 million visitors annually and churning off some $300 million a year in cash, 14 times what it did the year before Blackstone bought it. It had grown from 700 employees to more than 13,000, including 1,000 hired to fill new jobs stemming from organic growth unrelated to the mergers. Merlin was flourishing, with profits at existing properties ticking up at double-digit rates for 10 years, not counting the add-ons. Varney and Barada say the company is now poised to generate more growth internally, with chainable, brandable attractions like Legoland and Sea Life. New sites can be rolled out at a fraction of the cost of a Disneyland-scale park. And with its big acquisitions under its belt, Merlin set out to expand in the United States, where it was building new Legoland and Sea Life sites. In 2010, it also bought the Cypress Gardens Park in Florida, where it planned to create another Legoland. Like Disney's parks, Merlin's are aimed at families, but Merlin's are in or near major urban centers and cater to day visitors, so they are cheaper. Private equity ownership itself was an essential element in turning Varden's small-time Sea Life business into a major international company, Varney says. In terms of the speed and focus of what we've done, you just couldn't do that in the public arena. We could not be where we could be without private equity. Merlin planned an IPO in early 2010, but called that off when European markets were shaken by worries about Greece's solvency. Instead, Blackstone sold a 20% stake to CVC Capital Partners, a big London buyout firm, in a deal that valued Merlin at $3.6 billion. Including the 34% stake it retained, Blackstone's original investment was worth 3.5 times what it invested. Travelport Limited. In an era when lean operations are a mantra in the corporate world, there are fewer and fewer companies crying out to have their operations streamlined. The travel reservations company, Travelport Limited, however, was riddled with the sort of inefficiencies that whet the appetites of private equity investors. Moreover, it threw off a bounty of cash, $554 million in 2006, that could support several $1 billion of LBO debt. In short, it was an ideal LBO candidate. When Travelport's parent, Cendant Corporation, put Travelport on the block in 2006, Blackstone's Chip Shore was eager to bid. At Citicorp Venture Capital, where Shore had worked before Blackstone, he led a 2003 investment in WorldSpan Technologies, one of Travelport's chief competitors, and had wrung costs out there. His plan for Travelport called for a similar dose of old-fashioned cost-cutting, plus a merger and a spin-off that would produce a bigger but more svelte Travelport. The deal brought Blackstone full circle with one of its formative investments, for Cendant was the reincarnation of the HFS hotel franchise business Blackstone had owned in the early 90s, and was still headed by Henry Silverman, the Blackstone partner whom Prudential had forced to resign in 1991. Through scores of acquisitions, Cendant had morphed into a sprawling franchising and travel business, with brands ranging from Wyndham Hotels to the Avis and Budget car rental chains. Real estate brokerages such as Coldwell Banker and Century 21, and Travelport and its online reservation subsidiary, Orbitz.com. For years, Cendant had quenched the stock market's thirst for relentless and predictable gains in revenues and profits by acquiring scores of companies. Unfortunately, that strategy was sometimes at odds with maximizing the potential of the businesses, because restructuring can stunt revenue, increase expenses, and lead to write-offs that depress earnings in the near term. By 2005, Sendent's buy, buy, buy strategy was no longer paying off in the stock market, and Silverman, who had devoted 15 years to building the empire, concluded that Sendent would be worth more in pieces than as a whole, and the company announced it would split itself into four businesses. When Sendent auctioned Travelport the next year, Blackstone beat out Apollo with a $4.3 billion offer. Blackstone supplied $775 million of the $900 million of equity, and Technology Crossover Ventures, a venture capital firm, put up the balance. 5 months after the deal closed, One Equity Partners, the private equity arm of J.P. Morgan Chase, put in $125 million. Blackstone later lifted its investment to just over $800 million. Shortly before the sale, Silverman installed Jeffrey Clark, a veteran cost slasher, as Travelport CEO. Clark had led the integration of Compaq Computer into Hewlett-Packard after the rival PC makers merged in 2002. The 25,000 jobs eliminated yielded more than $3 billion in annual savings and paved the way for HP to later overtake Dell as the world's largest PC maker. Travelport, which was the product of 22 acquisitions in 4 years, was ripe for Clark's scalpel. And when the buyout closed in August 2006, Clark set to work, aided by Patrick Bork, a veteran technology executive Shore recruited because of his success chopping expenses at WorldSpan under Shore's old firm. A first wave of cuts zeroed in on obvious excess. The 25 data centers Travelport had piled up during the buying jag were whittled to 3, resulting in hundreds of employees and contract workers being let go. Other information technology jobs were cut when Clark dumped hundreds of costly new product research projects and channeled resources instead to 20 or so projects deemed most critical. Two further moves saved another $60 million a year. Travelport ditched the thousands of dedicated leased phone lines that it had used to communicate with travel agents and switched to far cheaper internet links. And it ended an expensive outsourcing contract with IBM to run mainframe computers, replacing them with a network of cheaper server computers it could operate in-house. By the spring of 2007, cash flows were so robust that Travelport borrowed $1.1 billion and paid most of it out as a dividend. With that, Blackstone and Technology Crossover recouped virtually their entire investment, 7 months after they invested. As Clark worked on the internal streamlining, Shore was out making deals, negotiating to buy WorldSpan from its private equity owners and preparing to spin off Orbit's retail travel website in an IPO. Adding WorldSpan would beef up Travelport's core business, catering to travel agents and airlines. Splitting off the consumer-focused Orbitz, which accounted for about 30% of revenues, would leave Travelport as a pure back-end business-to-business enterprise and resolve lurking conflicts between the consumer and wholesale sides of its operations. Orbitz competes both with Travelport's travel agent customers and with other travel websites that rely on Travelport's reservation system. WorldSpan would substantially boost Travelport's market share among travel agents, particularly in Europe, and WorldSpan had better technology that could be incorporated into Galileo, Travelport's reservation system. The companies also had dovetailing airline customer bases. Travelport hosted United Airlines data, and WorldSpan serviced Delta and Northwest. Together, they would vie as an equal against the two biggest back-office reservation systems at the time, Sabre, which was number one in the United States, and Amadeus, Europe's market leader. A $1.4 billion agreement for WorldSpan was sewn up in December 2006 to be paid for almost entirely with new borrowings. And in July 2007, Travelport sold 41% of Orbitz to the public, netting $477 million, which it used to pay down debt. Less than a year after the buyout, Travelport was a very different business. When the WorldSpan merger closed in August 2007, a second round of cuts began, as overlaps were eliminated, producing another $195 million of savings. By Clark's tally, Travelport whacked $390 million a year in operating expenses in the 3 years after the buyout, a staggering amount. That was 54% of its cash flow in 2008, the first full year after WorldSpan was absorbed. Put another way, the cuts together with the addition of WorldSpan doubled Travelport's cash flow. Along the way, there were 1,600 layoffs and 600 more jobs shed through attrition. But the company also added 1,600 jobs after the buyout, including programmers familiar with the Linux operating system used by the new servers, who replaced programmers specializing in IBM mainframe computers. The net loss of 600 jobs amounted to about 10% of the Travelport and WorldSpan workforce, excluding Orbitz. The new hires, some of whom were in Eastern Europe, India, and the Middle East, were generally younger and lower paid than the ones they replaced. Buying and integrating WorldSpan has been the biggest single value driver since I've been here, says Clark. After the synergies from combining the two companies, he figures that Blackstone, in effect, bought it for under 4 times cash flow, so it was a fantastic buy. Silverman had seen the potential years earlier in WorldSpan and had contemplated buying it, but to realize the cost savings, Sendint would have had to take big write-offs, hurting its earnings. There are a lot of things we might have done with Travelport that we as a public company could not do, says Silverman. Blackstone, which was focused only on building the long-term value of the company, didn't have to worry about Travelport's booking expenses tied to the makeover that would cripple its share price. Blackstone was thus able to capture the benefits of the restructuring. Even when it was pummeled by the drop-off in travel in the recession, Travelport spewed off cash, roughly $650 million in 2009. It was therefore able to take advantage of the meltdown in the credit markets and bought in some of its own bonds with a face value of more than $1 billion at a bargain basement price of 46 cents on the dollar, shrinking its total debt to $4 billion. At that level, its cash flow was nearly 2.5 times its cash interest expense, giving it a healthy margin of safety. Since Blackstone recovered virtually all its investment via the dividend in 2007, anything it collected after would be almost all profit. If Blackstone had sold in the recession of 2009, it might well have doubled its money. As the travel market rebounded and valuations headed up in 2010, the deal was primed to deliver a still greater payoff when Blackstone chooses to sell. None of these investments was a pure cost-cutting play. In each case, Blackstone spearheaded acquisitions that enlarged and radically reframed the business. Only with Travelport was cost reduction a major element of the strategy. And even there, the biggest cuts came when overlaps were eliminated as WorldSpan was absorbed. In fact, none of these three deals fits the simple LBO model. Many other Blackstone investments likewise deviate from the paradigm. When the firm ceded 2 reinsurance companies after 9/11, those were pure equity plays, without leverage. Other major investments like Kosmos Energy, an oil and gas exploration company Blackstone formed with Warburg Pincus in 2004, and Scythe Global Power, which builds and operates electric power plants, were startups. Blackstone's ill-fated investment in the cable TV systems in Germany in 2000 and 2001, too, had more in common with a startup investment than a standard LBO built upon existing cash flow. The companies were leveraged, but the equity Blackstone and other backers put in was used to finance the upgrading of their networks so that they could become full-fledged telecom companies offering phone and internet service as well as cable TV. The common strand that runs through all these cases is that Blackstone saw the companies through tricky transitions that public market forces and their prior owners would have made difficult, if not impossible. The CEOs, Herberg, Vernet, Silverman, and Clark, like Celanese's David Weidman, testify to the impediments they faced trying to undertake big changes when their businesses were part of public companies that felt pressure to maintain steady earnings, even if the changes would improve financial performance in the long term. Under private equity owners, the managements were free to look out several years. The investors assumed the risks of making the changes because they controlled the company. As standalone businesses with private equity owners, the companies were able to achieve much more of their potential. Apart from the pressure public company executives face from shareholders to deliver fast results, the compensation systems at public companies often fail to create incentives for managers to maximize long-term value. Too often they make short-term success paramount, the most glaring example being the bonus programs at major banks, which in the years leading up to the financial crisis rewarded bankers and traders for taking huge short-term risks that sank, or nearly sank, the institutions. The contrast between public company pay packages and the ones private equity firms install is striking. Under buyout firms, bonuses may be rewarded for increases in cash flow or other benchmarks over the midterm. But the real payoff for managers comes from their equity stakes, and they collect those gains only when companies are sold, a strong inducement for them to focus on improving the companies to make them more attractive to buyers. Moreover, CEOs and other senior managers are usually required to invest money in their companies and not just collect stock or options for free. Hence, they have their own money at risk. Furthermore, if a manager doesn't measure up, he or she is much more likely to be turfed out quickly because the company's directors are chosen by the owners, not by the CEO, as they often are in practice at big companies, and the executive won't walk away rich. At public companies, too often stock options vest when an executive is fired, so he or she receives a windfall for failing. Private equity firms typically structure the pay packages so that executives forfeit unvested equity, and severance is usually miserly compared with that of public companies, a year or two of base salary at most. It's hard to measure how much the alignment of interests between managers and shareholders contributes to private equity-owned companies, but it is a crucial component of this alternative form of ownership, particularly when a company needs to chart a new course. Chapter 26. Follow the Money. It was easy to understand why obituaries were written for big private equity. Heading into the second decade of the new century, the business looked to be in a dire, even terminal state. Some thought it was destined to suffer the same fate that venture capital had in the 2000s, shriveling to a fraction of its former size. Market conditions had eviscerated the buyout business once before, at the end of the 80s. More than 18 years passed before the records KKR set with the buyouts of Beatrice Foods and RJR Nabisco in 1986 and 1988 were eclipsed. And it wasn't until 2002 that KKR topped its $6.1 billion 1987 fund. The competitive landscape within private equity is bound to change as limited partners tally up whose portfolios held up and whose suffered unforgivable or catastrophic losses. Apollo, Cerberus, Fortress, Thomas H. Lee Partners, and other firms that miscalculated more often than the rest will face skeptical investors the next time they go to raise money, unless they somehow recoup their losses by making smart investments at the bottom of the market. For all its wounds, though, private equity was weathering the crisis better than other essential suppliers of capital. It emerged with most of its capital intact, while commercial and investment banks were hobbled by astronomical losses on mortgage products and derivatives. The buyout funds raised in 2005 to 2007 may end up delivering disappointing returns, just as many funds raised at the peaks of the market at the end of the 80s and 90s did. But the real test for private equity will be how it performs as an asset class against other investments. Notwithstanding the risks of leverage and the private equity-backed companies that went under, private equity funds have beaten the overall average returns at major pension funds over the last 3, 5, and 10 years. For pension managers who need to make up for losses in stocks and real estate in 2007 to 2009, private equity will seem very tempting. Even without new contributions, though, private equity firms have roughly $500 billion in their coffers at a time when other institutions are struggling to raise capital. The vast reserve ensures that private equity will play a major role as the economy recovers. By late 2009, private equity had started to reemerge, just as it had in 2002, when the economy and markets were still in the dumps after the end of the tech boom and 9/11. The first signs were a string of distressed debt plays, typically the opening round of a new cycle of investments. Veteran vulture investment firms such as Oaktree Capital Management, Ares Management, and Cerberus were snatching up debt of distressed companies in hopes of gaining control of them. Many of the targets had been owned by buyout firms. Apollo, which made its name as a vulture in the early 1990s, picking up the pieces of Drexel-backed companies that got in trouble, quickly joined in the scavenging, snatching control of a failing German roofing materials maker, Monier Group, from one of France's biggest private equity shops, PAI Partners. It also teamed up with Ares to buy Alaris, an aluminum company formerly owned by TPG out of bankruptcy, and partnered with Cerberus and Goldman Sachs to take over the British casino operator Gala Coral Group, which had been owned by three of the biggest British buyout shops, Permira, Candover, and Cinven. But the vulture game works both ways, as Apollo discovered when Ares took control of the former's ailing British real estate brokerage franchisor, Countrywide, by buying up its debt. In most cases where the vultures descended, the companies continued in business. The owners and vulture creditors were simply fighting over who would lose how much and who would emerge with control. Wall Street at its opportunistic, merciless best. In addition to the debt plays, beginning at the end of 2008, there was also a trickle of private equity-sponsored bank bailouts. J.C. Flowers and Company, a buyout firm that invests exclusively in financial institutions and other investors, bought a collapsed California mortgage lender, IndyMac, from federal bank regulators. After looking at more than 40 institutions, in May 2009, Blackstone joined with Carlyle Centerbridge Partners, the buyout shop founded by ex-Blackstone partner Mark Gologli, and turnaround artist Wilbur Ross, to buy Florida's Bank United, another deal orchestrated by the regulators. Late in 2009, Blackstone began making more conventional investments. It bought the Busch Gardens theme parks for $2.7 billion from the brewer Anheuser-Busch InBev NV adding more visitor attractions to its portfolio alongside Merlin Entertainment and Universal Orlando. Another of its companies, Pinnacle Foods, which owns well-known brands such as Swanson and Armour Meats, bought the Birds Eye Frozen Foods business for $1.3 billion. Blackstone's real estate group, meanwhile, came to the rescue of two overstretched commercial property companies, buying a half interest in the Broadgate office complex in London from British Land, and a 60% stake in two shopping malls owned by a property firm in Ohio. Perhaps more important than the new investments for the future of the business were the exits from older investments. The IPO and credit markets reopened just enough beginning in the fall of 2009 that there was a chance again to take some profits after a two-year drought. The first big company out of the gate was Dollar General Corporation, a discount retailer KKR bought in July 2007. KKR made a 150% gain on paper, showing that some investments made at the peak of the market could turn a hefty profit. Blackstone quickly followed with an IPO of Team Health, which provides health care staff to hospitals and other institutions, more than doubling its money on paper after 4 years. Soon after, Graham Packaging, which Blackstone had held since 1998, went public, yielding a modest profit on paper. Carlyle, Cerberus, TPG, and others also managed IPOs of portfolio companies in late 2009. Around the same time, corporations came out of hibernation and began making acquisitions again, creating another avenue for exits. The pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline paid $3.6 billion for Stiefel Laboratories Incorporated, a dermatological drug maker that was one quarter owned by Blackstone. Blackstone booked a 40% gain, barely 2 years after investing. A few months later, Blackstone doubled its money on a 2006 investment in Orangina Schweppes Group, the soft drink company, when the Japanese drinks company Suntory Holdings Limited bought it for $2.7 billion. Kosmos Energy, the company exploring for oil off the west coast of Africa, that Blackstone and Warburg Pincus had seeded in 2004, meanwhile, received an offer for one of its fields where it had confirmed big oil deposits. That promised to yield a huge profit for Kosmos's backers. Even dividend recapitalization staged a comeback. While credit in general was tight, healthy companies could borrow again, and private equity firms jumped at the chance to take some money out of their companies. Vanguard Health Systems, a hospital operator owned by Blackstone, borrowed to pay a $300 million dividend. Astonishingly, HCA Incorporated, the hospital chain KKR had bought for $33 billion in 2006, was doing so well that it borrowed to pay its backers two dividends in early 2010, totaling $2.3 billion. HCA followed that by filing to go public. The profit-taking was crucial for the industry because it would prime the fundraising pump again. Every dollar returned to an investor was one less dollar in their private equity allocation and had to be replaced. It was the first step toward restoring the virtuous cycle of profits and fresh fundraising that sustained the business in the 2000s. In the short term, private equity will have less capital at its disposal because its investors' assets have fallen in value, and with them, the absolute amounts they can invest. After 2 years of knocking on investors' doors, by July 2010, Blackstone had raised just $13.5 billion for its next buyout fund, a huge come-down from the $21.7 billion fund it closed in 2007. KKR postponed its fundraising plans altogether in 2009 because its investors were tapped out. Until buyout firms realize profits and send money back to the pension plans and other investors, their asset pools will slowly shrink. Even so, the longer-term trends work in the favor of private equity, for as populations in the developed world age, pension plans will have more money to deploy, and private equity is likely to gain a bigger share of a bigger pot. In 2009, when private equity was taken for dead, three of the largest public pension funds, the trendsetting CalPERS and CalSTRS in California, and New York State's pension plan, each decided to raise the portion of their assets going to private equity. In the post-crisis era, private equity won't look like it did in 2006 and 2007, to be sure. Even the protagonists recognized at the time that it was a freakish period, too good to be true. With hindsight, the $20 billion-plus deals may look as anomalous as RJR Nabisco was in its day, when it was nearly four times the size of the next biggest LBO to that point. It may take a generation before there are buyouts on the scale of TXU, EOP, or Hilton again, many people in the business believe. The big question for private equity and its importance in the capital markets is not when the next $40 billion buyout occurs, but how long it takes before there are $5 billion or $10 billion deals, deals big enough to sustain private equity organizations on the scale they had operated at before the crash. The securitization of buyout loans and junk bonds and other debt-like mortgages created a credit bubble, so when leverage returns, it will not be on the same monumental scale seen in the mid-2000s. Still, the debt markets are vastly more sophisticated and deeper than they were in the 1980s, when the collapse of one firm, Drexel Burnham, put the buyout business on ice for years. Two decades on, LBO financing is provided by scores of institutions around the globe. Notwithstanding the contraction of credit, the private equity business will rebound for no other reason than its $500 billion capital stockpile. Blackstone alone went into 2010 with $29 billion to invest in corporate buyouts, real estate, and debt, the largest pool of any of the big private equity houses. If history is a guide, that money will earn rich returns because investments made when the economy was weak have performed best. Buyouts in 1991 and 1992 and 2001 and 2002 earned returns near 30% on average, about double what investments in other years made, and the most successful funds ever were those raised and deployed at earlier troughs in the business cycle. It isn't just the enormous war chest that ensures the industry's long-term survival, though. Private equity has carved out a unique role for itself. Today, private equity is best understood as a parallel capital market and an alternative, transitional form of corporate ownership. Unlike the money a company raises in the stock or bond markets or with a bank loan, this capital comes with an agenda attached, and the supplier of the capital has the power to see that plan carried out. Put another way, private equity takes risks that other investors don't want to shoulder in exchange for control and high returns. The LBO continues to be the paradigm and will come to the fore again when the debt markets recover, but it no longer defines the business. At lows in the business cycle, buyout capital is used to deleverage struggling or bankrupt businesses, or to buy debt at big discounts, because undercapitalized and distressed companies have the most upside for investors in a bad economy. In better times, investment flows to companies that need operational improvements. Some money will also go to stake startup businesses, as it did with the two reinsurers Blackstone helped form after September 11th, and with Kosmos Energy, the oil exploration company. The common thread in all these, except for pure debt trading, is that private equity serves as a bridge between two stages of the company's life. Just as venture capitalists fund young companies and lend management and market know-how, private equity has developed into a form of ownership where other forms of capital and ownership have fallen short. Sometimes the target is a public company, like Celanese or Safeway, that has not rationalized its businesses to maximize long-term value, or a major subsidiary of a public company, such as Travelport or Hertz, that hadn't received the management it deserved. In other cases, private equity firms step in when a subsidiary such as Merlin or Gerresheimer has had its ambitions thwarted by its parent. In distressed and turnaround investments, private equity buyers provide capital and bear the risks while a troubled business regains its footing. Not only has the nature of private equity investing evolved beyond the LBO, the firms themselves have branched out. All of these large buyout firms are now in the process of transforming themselves from being just private equity firms into alternative investment management firms, says David Rubenstein, the co-founder of Carlyle. Since the last downturn, Blackstone and most of its peers have become global businesses, managing a variety of asset categories and investing in emerging economies such as China and India. Three firms, Fortress, Blackstone, and after a long delay, KKR, have gone public, and Apollo hopes to soon, a process that forced them to complete the transition from secretive personal fiefdoms to mainstream institutions. Private equity still must contend with the refinancing crunch that looms in 2012 to 2014, when the companies bought in the peak years will need to repay their loans and bonds and find new financing. Some companies, worth less than their debts, will surely be forfeited to creditors, their backers writing off their investments. But predictions of catastrophic waves of failure are probably overstated. Lenders and private equity firms alike have several years to renegotiate and postpone maturities. Billions in loans were modified, reduced, or extended in 2009 and 2010, and billions more were certain to be replaced or extended by the time the original due dates come around. By the spring of 2010, for instance, the $34 billion in debt that was originally scheduled to come due at Blackstone Companies in 2013 had been reduced to just $15 billion through a combination of restructurings, extensions, and debt purchases. Its competitors had similarly worked down their totals in order to avoid a refinancing crisis. There will be a day of reckoning, but it won't sink the private equity business or the economy. Meanwhile, new regulatory constraints on banks may work to private equity's benefit, forcing big banks to retrench in the areas where they encroached on private equity's turf. Some of the biggest competitors of Blackstone's real estate group, for instance, were the property investment arms of Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, and Lehman Brothers. Each has severely shrunk or disappeared from real estate private equity altogether, after suffering big losses. The financial reforms of 2010 will limit how much of their own capital banks can invest in buyouts, which could curb rivals such as Goldman Sachs Capital Partners and the private equity operations of other banks, such as Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and Credit Suisse. At the same time that banks pull back, private equity firms are pushing further onto what had been the bank's exclusive territory, as Blackstone had from the beginning with its M&A and restructuring groups. KKR served notice in 2007 that it was setting up its own securities arm to sell shares and bonds. In part, this was a bid to service its own companies, cutting banks out of the loop and generating underwriting fees for itself. But KKR aims to be more than an in-house service unit. By 2010, it had participated in more than 15 offerings, including floating bonds for Britain's leading sports franchise, the Manchester United soccer team, in which KKR had no stake. If we don't reinvent ourselves continually, we're dead, Schwartzman likes to tell his troops. At the end of the day, there are thousands of sources of pure capital. The trick is to supply something extra. Amid the financial upheaval, Blackstone was observing that maxim, elaborating on the concept of private equity through new investments and investment vehicles in China. On the heels of the investment by China's sovereign wealth fund, Chinese Investment Corporation, in Blackstone in 2007, Blackstone took a minority stake in China Blue Star, a state-owned specialty chemicals company, for $500 million, and agreed to work with it to acquire chemical makers elsewhere in the world. 2 years later, Blackstone's real estate group invested with a local Chinese developer to build a shopping mall, and the firm followed that by launching a $730 million private equity fund denominated in the Chinese renminbi currency that will invest in the Shanghai region. Carlyle was forming a similar fund in Beijing. It wasn't Blackstone's capital that won at these roles. The Chinese have a surplus of capital. Instead, Blackstone was parlaying its financial, management, and real estate know-how into stakes in high-growth businesses. At the same time, CIC said it would invest $500 million in Blackstone's hedge fund of funds, suggesting a rich new vein of capital for Blackstone to tap. Coming out of the crisis, Blackstone's buyout portfolio had withstood the crunch better than many of its competitors, and because it had fallen behind in the race to launch public investment funds, it dodged the meltdown suffered by Apollo, Carlyle, and KKR's publicly traded debt funds. Blackstone remains the biggest firm, too. Only Carlyle is close in the amount of capital it manages of all types, with by far the most diversified mix of businesses. 25 years on, Blackstone still conforms to the blueprint Peterson and Schwartzman drew up in 1985 for a new form of financial institution built around private equity, with other niches added as opportunities arose. And as the Chinese initiatives show, Schwartzman hasn't lost his knack for finding and supplying capital, and for spotting a way for Blackstone to get its cut. This concludes King of Capital.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.